Now we can open up Revelation 18. Going to be in verses 9 through 19 tonight, a little bigger section than what we've normally been taking, but it all comes together, as we said, that Revelation 18 is really divided up into to about four different sections. We saw there was verses 1 through 3, there was the prediction of the angel of the fall of Babylon, and in verses 4 through 8 there was the call to come out of Babylon, and then in 9 through 19 there's the exposition or the announcement of the fall of Babylon, and then in 20 through 24 there's again the another angel's announcement or prediction of the fall and a rejoicing over the fall of Babylon. But as we get into verses 9 through 19, I'll read it here in just a minute, we're going to see that there's really laments here. It's a long lament and over the fall of Babylon. And this lament is really comprised of three groups. There's kings, there's the merchants, and then there's the people of the sea, or those who in some form or fashion make their living and their welfare is dependent upon the trade over the sea. We're going to see their reaction to Babylon's fall and the reason for the response of their response. And this reason, as we're going to see, is based on the particular self-interest of the group, the particular self-interest that's affected of the particular group. Let me read verses 9 through 19. And the kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her, that is with Babylon, will weep and lament over her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come." And the merchants of the earth weep and mourn over her because no one buys their cargoes anymore. Cargoes of gold and silver and precious stones and pearls and fine linen and purple and silk and scarlet and every kind of citron wood and every article of ivory and every article made from very costly wood and bronze and iron and marble and cinnamon and spice and incense and perfume and frankincense and wine and olive oil and fine flour and wheat and cattle and sheep and cargoes of horses and chariots and slaves and human lives. And the first fruit and the fruit you long for has gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you, and men will no longer find them. The merchants of these things who became rich from her will stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city, she who was clothed in fine linen and purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, for in 1 hour such great wealth has been laid waste. And every shipmaster and every passenger and sailor, and as many as make their living by the sea, stood at a distance and were crying out as they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, 'What city is like the great city?' And they threw dust on their heads and were crying out, weeping and mourning, saying, 'Woe, woe, the great city in which all who have ships at sea became rich by her wealth, for in 1 hour she has been laid waste.'" Now, when we look at this long lament, we're going to see the response of each one of these individual groups, the kings, the merchants, the people of the sea. The response is similar. Well, it's weeping, it's mourning. But the reason that they're weeping and mourning is based on the particular self-interest of the group. For the kings, we see in verse 10, "Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city." So for the kings, it was the fact that Babylon was a city of power, political influence, and being able to rule and dominate over the earth. But yet for the merchants, we see they mourn over her in verse 11 because no one buys their cargoes anymore. And the merchants' lament is much longer than the kings and much longer than the people who make their living by the sea, because they're the ones who are affected probably the most. All their hope of economic gain, everything they based their life on, they're worshipers of money. And all their hope, this false sense of valuation is gone. It's gone. Now, it's interesting that we see these same three groups are found in Ezekiel 26 and 28. And we're not really going to go there because we don't have time. But Ezekiel 26 and 28 is talking about the fall of Tyre. And so much of what's going on here is parallel to God's description of the fall of Tyre. And of course, Tyre was a major seaport city, very powerful at its time, controlled a lot of trade, but God eventually destroyed Tyre because of their haughty, proud, arrogant attitude toward Israel. When Israel fell, Tyre rejoiced because now they became the dominant trading entity within that region. Their monopolies were in concrete. They were controlling all the trade, and so they rejoiced. And so in response to their sinful attitude toward Israel and the fall of Israel, God wiped Tyre, God destroyed Tyre. And He did so Tyre was really composed of two cities. There was one that was on the shore, but part of the city was on an island offshore that was only accessible by sea. And so what Alexander the Great did was he came in and he destroyed the city that was on the shore, took all the rubble from it, built a causeway out to the island, and then destroyed the city there. And Tyre was since rebuilt by the Romans, and there are the ruins of it there today. But much of what we see has some parallels to the descriptions of what's going on in Tyre. And these same groups are found in Ezekiel 26 through 28, the kings, the merchants, the seagoing people. And, well, I said we weren't going to turn over there, but I'll just flip over there real quick. Ezekiel 26, verses 15 through 18, we see the kings. It said, "Thus says the Lord God to Tyre, shall not the coastline shake at the sound of your fall, when the wounded groan, when the slaughter occurs in your midst? Then all the princes of the sea will go down from their thrones, remove their robes, and strip off their embroidered garments. They will clothe themselves with trembling. They will sit on the ground, trembling every moment, and be appalled at you. And they will take up a lamentation over you and say to you, how you have perished, O inhabited one." So we see these kings, these princes, lamenting over the fall of Tyre. Well, this first group, we see the kings of the earth. This is different than the 10 kings that are described in chapter 17. They're going to side with the beast, form an alliance with the beast, and they give their power to the beast for a short period of time for one purpose, and that purpose is to destroy Babylon. So these kings of the earth are different than the 10 kings. They're other political entities within the world, rulers of other nations that have ties to Babylon. When they're the same kings of the earth that's mentioned in 18 verse 3, where it says, "All the nations of the earth have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality, and the kings of the earth have committed acts of immorality with her." Now, we've seen before that acts of immorality so often in the Bible are not necessarily moral or immoral in the sense of opposite of moral. They're immoral in the sense that they're involved in idolatry. I mean, the greatest immorality is idolatry. And of course, much of idolatry, especially in the ancient world, involved acts of immorality. But the immorality that the kings of the earth are involved in is just spiritual harlotry, spiritual adultery. Now, there's an interesting grammatical change that occurs in this passage that we need to point out. In verse 9 and 10, John writes, when he talks about the kings of the earth and their lament, verses 9 and 10, John is talking about the future tense, that this is going to be something that's happening in the future. Whereas in verses 11 through 14, when he's talking about the lament of the merchants, That's in the present tense. He's writing in the present tense there. And then in verses 15 and 16, again talking of the merchants, he switches to the future tense, back to the future tense. And then in verses 17 through 19, he switches to the past tense. So much of this is stylistic, but it's also there for emphasis. So in verse 3 we saw, chapter 3, or verse 3 of chapter 18, we saw that the kings commit immorality and the merchants become rich. Here the kings do both in verse 9. Kings of the earth who committed acts of immorality and lived sensuously with her. So here again, there's the spiritual adultery and the pursuit of wealth we see depicted in the Bible so often just go hand in hand. You know, God doesn't condemn wealth per se within the Bible. What He condemns is the sinful use of wealth and the sinful acquisition of wealth and the sinful use of wealth, the self-indulgent, extravagant, luxurious lifestyles, especially at the expense of other people. Now, their reaction to seeing the destruction of Babylon, it says they will weep and lament or mourn over her when they see the smoke of her burning. Now, this word weeping, there's a couple different words in the Greek for weep or cry. You know, we think of in John chapter 11 when Jesus comes after Lazarus has died, and we have the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. Well, the word that's used there is not just out and out crying. It's more as just a tear streaming down the cheek, your eyes puddling up. Whereas here, the word for weeping is an open crying, a sobbing, just intense agony. And the word lament here, will weep and lament, the root word of that really means to beat or to cut. And we think of the parable that Jesus told of the tax gatherer in the temple. The tax gatherer and the Pharisee. The Pharisee standing there praying to himself. But the tax gatherer is beating his chest, beating himself, lamenting, mourning over his sin. Well, here they are mourning over their loss of Babylon. So what we have a picture here is this loud, noisy wailing going on by the kings of the earth. It's the same response that Israel is going to have to the recognition of the Messiah. In chapter 1, verse 7, "Behold, He is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see Him, even those who pierced Him, and all the tribes of the earth," that is, the tribes of Israel, "will mourn over Him. Even so, amen." And of course, that's referring also to Zechariah 12:10, where we see this mourning of Israel over what they did to their Messiah. This loud lamentation, the sense of their loss. Well, here the loss is over a political realm. So we have this picture of intense sorrow and overwhelming grief. Well, why? Why? Because they see the smoke of her burning. See, this is more than the loss of the city. But it's what the city represents. See, this is what the 10 kings were going to do. Chapter 17, verse 16 says that these 10 kings, 10 horns, and the beast, that they're going to hate the harlot, make her desolate, naked, eat her flesh, will burn her up with fire. And in chapter 18, verse 8, "For this reason, one day her plagues will come, pestilence, mourning, and famine, and she will be burned up with fire." So here, she's burning. And it's not just the loss of the city, but it's what the city represents, the power, the wealth, the security, the status, the luxury, the self-gratification. It's all gone. All gone. But it even goes deeper than this. It goes deeper over the sense of just this temporal loss. See, when these terms, this weeping and lament, just like with the nation of Israel and their lament over the Son of Man when they see Him, it's coming from an awakened knowledge of God, an awakened knowledge and a realization of the consequences of ungodliness, the consequences of self-gratification, the consequences of self-worship. And this realization of their false security, their misplaced valuations. Now Jesus, on His way to the cross, met with some women, chapter 23, verse 27 of Luke. They were following Him, a great multitude of the people and of women, who were mourning and lamenting Him. But Jesus turned to them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, stop weeping for Me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do these things in the green tree, what will happen in the dry?" Now if they do these things, when I'm present, what are they going to do when I'm not? You need to be mourning for yourself over your loss, over this rejection of the Messiah. James has a similar command to the wealthy, those who have put their hope in all the things of this world. James chapter 5, verse 1. "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you." There again, we just see this intense agony, intense grief. Weep and howl for your miseries which are coming on you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. Behold, the pay of the laborers who has mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you. And the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabbath. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. You have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you." So there's just this exploitation, an opulence. The smoke of her burning recalls the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Remember, God prophesied, or Isaiah prophesied, that the destruction of Babylon would be just like that of Sodom and Gomorrah. Not only referring to the swiftness and the total devastation, but even the means, the burning with smoke. So the reason, again, for their mourning was the loss of their political power. They say, "Woe, woe, the great city Babylon, the strong city," again, referring to her political power. And the double use of woe, again, is just an expression of sorrow and horror. Over just the suddenness of the fall, in 1 hour your judgment has come. In other words, just a loss of all hope, all security. Notice they were standing at a distance. Standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment. It's interesting that the word torment originally meant, in its root, originally meant to test. But eventually came to mean to torture, to put on the rack. Because when you tested something to test the worth of a metal or the value of a coin or the genuineness of a coin, they used a particular type of stone to test it with. Well, of course, when they put you on the rack, what did they do? They would hang a big stone as a weight that would pull on you. So it meant to be tested by a stone. So it eventually came to mean being put on the rack, to being tortured, to test the genuineness of something, the truth, to try to extract the truth from somebody through these means, or to test the genuineness of something. So they stand at a distance because of the fear of her torment. In other words, her worth is just being proven here. Ultimately, it's nothing. It's nothing. It's all superficial. It's all worldly wealth. And they're standing at the distance because of the fear of their torment. In other words, it's fear that they might suffer the same fate. So they're staying back. It's just pure self-preservation. There's no attempt to save the city. So again, we see self-dominating. It's all about self. It's power for self. Power, political power, economic power. And it's all about self-preservation. Self-interest is first importance. There was this bunker mentality. And we see this really expressed in many people today. I remember when Y2K came around? There was this bunker mentality, and people were hoarding food and stockpiling even weapons. And I know of a few people. There was one guy here in the Brentwood area who was a well-known Brentwood businessman, even ran for Congress at one time, who sold his big home in Brentwood and moved his family to a double-wide trailer way down Pulaski out in the middle of the country because he was going to protect his family from all this calamity that was going to come about because of Y2K. Well, that's just not the godly response. That's what the ungodly do, is self-preservation. That's their attitude. That's not the attitude of a Christian. Is this self-preservation? We're going to keep what's ours and make sure nobody else gets any of it? Again, they're just shocked by the suddenness of it. Like Sodom and Gomorrah, this is no slow, gradual decay. It's in 1 hour your judgment has come. Then we see the second group, the merchants, in verse 11. The merchants of the earth weep and mourn. Again, the same expression, same response to this intense agony. But it's a different reason. Because no one buys their cargoes anymore. See, they're devastated by their loss of their most lucrative and profitable customer. See, Babylon's self-indulgence fed their self-indulgence. You know, the more they bought, the better off they were. So they were just feeding on each other's self-indulgence, self-gratification, opulence, luxurious living. Money was their god. I mean, we can think of this today. It's not hard to imagine. What if the U.S. stopped buying from Japan or from China? What would happen to those economies? You know, there'd be a lot of people standing back saying, whoa, whoa, nobody's buying our stuff anymore. Now, this is kind of ironic because these merchants belong to a system that denied people the ability to buy and sell unless they had the mark of the beast. But yet, because they do have the mark of the beast, they're no longer have the ability to sell their goods. It's all going up in flames. Yeah, you just see this mentality, even present today, this we're going to get what we're going to get, and it doesn't matter who gets hurt in the process, who we have to exploit. We see it in the corporate world today. We just think, back in the 1940s, 30s, and 40s in corporate America, the average CEO's salary was about 10 times what the guy on the assembly line was making. So if your guy on your assembly line was making, you know, $1,940, if he was making $3,000 a year, the CEO would have been making $30,000 a year. Well, today you can have a guy on the assembly line making $50,000 or $60,000 a year, maybe. But the CEO, he's not making $500,000 or $600,000. They're making $500,000 or $600 million, especially with the bonuses. So there's just this intense greed that's dominated American corporations and in business today, where it's the exploitation of whoever we have to get as much as we can. So here we see the second group of merchants. They're mourning because nobody's buying their cargo. Now this cargo or merchandise, which is described in verses 12 and 13, it consists of about seven categories here. Six or seven categories. But the thing they all have in common is that all of these items that are mentioned in this list of cargoes, all of them, they're from John's time, of course. They're not from the time of the fulfillment of the prophecy. But the main point is that all are items that are indicative of a luxurious, self-indulgent, splendid lifestyle. We see it in verse 14, the fruit that you long for is gone from you, and all things that were luxurious and splendid have passed from you. So, I mean, essentially this is the lifestyles of the rich and famous going up in smoke here, and everything that it took to feed that lifestyle is going. It's all associated with an opulent, luxurious lifestyle. Now, many of these items that are listed are also listed in tires. Destruction. Now, again, this is another indication that we're talking about literal Babylon here. Because these are merchants of the sea, primarily, that are mourning. And because these are cargoes that are coming in by ship. Well, again, Tyre was a major seaport. So the parallel we have here is that Babylon, also on the Euphrates River, had a major port. Now, this kind of rules out Rome, which has no seaport. It's smack in the middle of Italy. Rules out Jerusalem as being a mystical Babylon. Jerusalem doesn't have a seaport. Now, there's 28 or 29 items listed in this list of cargo. And something else that's interesting about this passage, there's 28 uses of the Greek word chi, which is translated end or even. And the reason that's interesting is because it's more than any other known literature in existence to have this long a string of the word end coming right after each other. 28 in a row, and. So the seven categories I mentioned, the first category, there's precious metals and jewels. The second category is luxurious, costly fabrics, clothing. And the third category is expensive, ornate furniture materials and furnishings. And number four, the fourth category is choice spices and fragrances and perfumes. I remember Debbie and I went on a cruise back before Rachel was born, and we stopped in St. Thomas, and a lady on the cruise ship came back on board, and we just heard her over talking, saying she just spent $400 on perfume. And it's like, $400 on perfume? I don't think I could ever smell that good. Then there's choice foods. Choice foods is the fifth item. The sixth item, agricultural animals, transportation, items of transportation, and agricultural animals. And then the seventh category is just the exploitation and traffic in human lives. Now, verse 12 lists items from the first three categories. First, there's the precious metals and jewels, gold, silver. Now, in ancient Rome, during the time of John, when John would be writing, and these things would have been indicative of the opulent, luxurious lifestyle that was led by many in Rome, gold and silver was typically imported from Spain. And again, both were an extravagant luxury in the Rome of John's day. And the people just loved to flaunt this stuff. And then there was precious stones or pearls. These would have been imported from India. And again, the wealthy in Rome were just engrossed with this. They wanted to wear them and flaunt them. And they also had the wealth to import them. Just the fact that they're importing this shows the wealth that's there, that they actually have the ability to import this stuff. And then the second category, the luxurious fabrics, we see fine linen. Now, fine linen was made from, it's a type of linen, a type of cloth that was made from Egyptian flax, a plant called byssus. And it was a very delicate, costly, very soft. It was white or kind of a creamy, yellowish white. And interestingly, it was also used for mummy coverings in Egypt. But it was a very light, very delicate, very expensive cloth. And then purple. Of course, purple fabrics, purple clothing in John's day was made. Purple was a dye that was made from a shellfish, and it was extracted one drop at a time. And actually, the dye was more costly than the fabric that it was used to dye. It was extremely expensive, and it was always a mark of royalty, a mark of wealth, a mark of extreme luxury to be able to afford purple. And it came from some of the places that are mentioned in the first three chapters of Revelation, Thyatira. Remember Lydia, who was converted by Paul in Acts chapter 16, was a seller of purple fabric. And she was from Thyatira. Thyatira was a major area of the production of purple, as well as Hierapolis, which was in the same area as Colossae. So it was just a mark of extreme wealth. And then there's silk. Silk was imported from China and India. And it was interesting, as I was studying this, why is silk called silk? Why does it have that name? Well, it's because it came from the Ceres, and that was the name of a people in Indian China that was conquered by Alexander the Great, and from which he procured this fabric. And so he named the fabric after the people, the Ceres, or silk. Now, it was interesting, for a short time in Rome, it was illegal for men to wear silk, but eventually it became used in the manufacture of all sorts of garments for men and women. And again, very luxurious. And then scarlet. Scarlet. Scarlet came from an oak in Asia Minor. And again, there's this Old Testament imagery. Scarlet in the Old Testament is typically always associated with sin. Now, Isaiah 1:18, though your sins be as scarlet, they will be white as snow. Or Jeremiah 4:30, that scarlet clothing was indicative of a sinful, luxurious, opulent lifestyle. And scarlet is also, you know, the color of the beast. And it's the color of the harlot's clothing. So purple and scarlet are the colors of very expensive clothing. And it was a sign of ungodly extravagance and worldly desire. So the colors fit the character of the harlot. Now the third category here is the expensive furniture materials. Every kind of citron wood. What's citron wood? Well, it's a type of tree called the Sadarac tree. It's in the cypress family. And it's a conifer. It's a native of North Africa, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. And it's, what's interesting, it's one of the few conifers that are able to regrow from sprouts after it's cut off its stump. Most conifers can't do that. I know you're just all dying to know what the botanical name of this plant is. So it's Tetraclinus articulata. That's the botanical name. You know I'd have to throw that in there. Yeah. Tetraclinus articulata. Just in case you want to look it up, Google it. But it's the citron wood. It was a hard, or is a hard, dark-colored wood. It's actually endangered now because of its overuse. But it was a hard, dark-colored wood, very fragrant, and it took a polish really well. Matter of fact, it was the most highly prized wood for furniture during the ancient world. It was actually considered worth its weight in gold. It was that valuable. And it was the price that someone would pay for just a single table made out of citron wood. Somebody could have bought a large estate for it, a huge estate. It also produced a resin called Sadarac, which was used for varnish and for incense. So this was a very costly, high-dollar wood. I mean, one thing I was reading talked about an ancient Greek philosopher had a table that today, that, well, actually this book was written back in the 1920s, so in 1920s money, that table would have been worth about $45,000 just for a little table. So today, you know, you're looking at probably close to a quarter of $1 million or more for a table made from this wood. Now, the next costly woods would said every kind of citron. And when it says every kind of citron wood, it's talking about everything that's made, every kind of article that would be made from this type of wood. And the same thing here, every article of ivory, every article made from very costly wood, bronze and iron and marble. It's talking about every item that would have been made from this. Here the next item was ivory, which of course would have been imported from India because by this time, Rome's lust for ivory had been so great that there was actually a shortage of ivory from Africa because the accessible areas of Africa had virtually been depleted of elephants for their ivory. So they were importing it from India. It was used for chairs, beds, dice, table legs. It was even used to make images of gods. And so the fact that ivory was being used to make images of gods instead of wood just shows the opulence and the wealth that was there, and the extravagant wealth. And then there was very costly wood. This probably would have been maple, cedar, cypress, ebony, just used for furniture, doors, veneers. And then bronze, iron, marble. These would have been used not only for tools and weapons, the bronze and the iron, but also for furniture, for utensils, building materials, the marble. And verse 13 gives us the last four categories, spices and fragrances. There's cinnamon. Now cinnamon, of course, comes from the bark of a tree, would have had to have been imported. It was used not only as an incense, it was used oftentimes in wine, to increase the potency of wine. The spice is a plant called amomum. It's a fragrant plant of India, and it produced a perfume that was used especially in the hair. And then incense. Of course, incense would have been just a mixture of different plants, materials. Perfume is the word muron. It just means an ointment. Any type of ointment. Remember, Mary anointed Jesus' feet. She broke an alabaster vial of pure nard. And the word there is ointment of nard. So nard was a type of ointment, a type of perfume. And of course, Judas got all upset over this because he said, why wasn't this sold for 300 denarii? Now, a denarii was a day's wage. So you're looking at a year's worth of income for one little alabaster vial of perfume. That's pretty self-indulgent to buy that. Why wasn't this sold for 300 denarii? Of course, Jesus told Judas to quit fussing, that she was saving this for his burial. He didn't condemn her for it. And then frankincense. Frankincense is, of course, as ancient almost as the Bible. Fragrance used in incense, perfumes, comes from Saudi Arabia, Somalia. It's interesting how they gather it. They cut incisions in the bark of the tree that this comes from and allow the sap to ooze out. And then the sap dries and crystallizes, and then they have to go back and flake it off. And it still all has to be done today. And the people who gather frankincense today have an interesting custom that when they go to the marketplace to sell their frankincense, they greet each other by rubbing their noses together, like Eskimos, because supposedly they're smelling each other's scent because they're frankincense dealers, and so they rub each other's noses. But frankincense, again, very costly. It was one of the gifts that the Magi brought to Jesus. Very costly. And then there's the choice foods. Wine, olive oil, fine flour, wheat. So the taste for wine within Rome was wine was a predominant drink, but Rome was just in excess of it. As a matter of fact, it became such a popular commodity that people who were growing wheat actually plowed their wheat under and started growing wine because it was, or grapes, or vineyards, because it was more profitable. Now, olive oil, fine flour. Fine flour was the finest type of wheat flour you could get. And then there's the cattle. What? No. What are you signaling? No. And there's the cattle and the sheep, cargoes of horses, chariots, slaves, human lives. And cattle and sheep were not used so much for eating as they were for work animals. Sheep were used predominantly, were brought in not so much for consumption as for breeding purposes to improve the quality of the wool that was being made and used. And then the chariots. These aren't chariots we think of, like the two-wheeled carts. They weren't instruments of war, not this type of chariot. This is a four-wheeled carriage. This is what the wealthy would have ridden around in. And then there's the human traffic. Slaves and human lives. Just see the contempt for human life, the contempt for others, the exploitation of others, just for the sake of self-profit, of self-advancement. Now verse 14, the lament continues, "The fruit you long for is gone from you. And all things," what are all things? All the things that we just listed. "All things that were luxurious and splendid have passed away from you." It's interesting, this word luxurious, lipavros. Now, there's medication people take today called what? Lipitor. And it's for what? High blood pressure. Or cholesterol. It's really taken to control cholesterol. Well, what's cholesterol? It's fat. Well, liparos, the word that's translated luxurious here, means oily, fatty. And so they've just taken the Greek word for oily, fatty, and named a medication out of it that's supposed to fight oils and fats in your bloodstream and in your veins. But it's just referring to a sumptuous, extravagant foods. So all things that were luxurious, sumptuous, extravagant foods. And then splendid. The word splendid here, lampros, means shining, bright, radiant. It's talking about luxurious, elegant clothing. Same word is used in James chapter 2, verses 2 and 3. It says, "For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, bright, shining, splendid clothes, there also comes in a poor man in dirty clothes, you pay special attention to the one who is wearing the fine clothes." So, it's talking about luxurious clothing, elegant clothing. And he says that all these things have passed away from you and men will no longer find them. That term "no longer" just translates oume. It's the strongest negation in the Greek, the strongest negative in the Greek. Never, ever to return. They're gone. Forever. Never to return. All this is gone. Well, this is toward the very end of the tribulation period, during the destruction of Babylon. All these things they longed for, this passionate longing, epithumia is the Greek word, just means the lust, desire, a passionate longing for. It's all gone. In verses 15 and 16, the merchants of these things who became rich from her, again, will stand at a distance as self-preservation because of the fear of her torment, weeping and mourning, saying, "Woe, woe, the great city. She was clothed," and then it mentions all these articles that were just in the cargo fine linen, purple, scarlet, adorned with gold, literally gilded with gold and precious stones and pearls. In 1 hour, such great wealth has been laid waste. So again, we see the self-preservation. And then the same attitude within the sea people. Every shipmaster, every passenger and sailor, as many as make their living by the sea, stood at a distance. Nobody goes to try to help. Nobody tries to rescue. Instead of praying, the same thing's going to happen to them. They're going to get on the bad side of the beast, the bad side of these 10 kings. And so it's all about self-preservation. It says they were crying out. It's in the imperfect tense, which means they were doing it continuously. This was just a long lament, wail that was going on because they lost their source of wealth. And so they cry out. Why are they crying out? The great city in which all who had ships at sea became rich by her wealth. Say again. Economic, it was all, the reason they're crying out with the woe is because of their own self-interest. In 1 hour, she's been laid waste. Now, this is a tragic end for the city of Babylon. It's a tragic end for the kings. It's a tragic end for all of those who've placed their hope in this system. But it's today, too. There are people. People who fill the pews of the churches. People who are willing to lose their soul to gain the world versus Christians who are willing to lose the world to gain their soul. They're willing to lose wealth, status, reputation, power, family, all to gain Christ. They're willing to die to self and self-interest versus living for self and self-interest. And this is what consumes our culture today. And so many people are going to watch it crumble. Maybe not in their lifetime, but they're going to hear, just like a foolish farmer, what good is it going to do you now? Tonight, your life is required of you. Why didn't you store up your treasure in heaven, where moth doesn't rust, where thieves break in and steal, where fire consumes like Babylon? See, these people ignored the calls to repentance. They ignored the calls to real faith. Real faith. Now, I've been studying John, preaching through John Sunday, and just hitting John 3:16. And when John writes, recording Jesus, that God sent the Son, gave His only begotten Son to whoever believes in Him. What does it mean to believe? What is true belief? What is true faith? Now, it's a total trust in Christ. A rejection of self, self-effort, self-reliance, total trust in Christ. And that's why faith always results in obedience. Because if you have total trust, you obey. But if you don't obey, you're just demonstrating you don't have trust. And so there's no genuine faith. So this is just endemic in the culture today in which we live especially. And it's all coming to an end. And people are going to cry out, "Whoa, whoa. All I put my hope in is gone." And that can't be us. That can't be us. I'm afraid today when so many people say they believe in Jesus, all they're simply saying is they're rejecting atheism. They don't really believe. They're just affirming who Jesus says He is. But there's no belief. There's no trust. They're just saying they're not an atheist. But they're not a Christian. And as a result, they've put their hope in something else.